noting that democracy has been in retreat for it's about the last 15 years, which is good to have that on the record because it's only the past few years that we've noticed it, but the trend is actually much longer than that. And yes, I mean, it'd be hard to characterize the United States as a fully functioning democracy, given the inappropriate role that money plays in our elections, given how difficult it is for such a big part of our citizenship to vote. I mean, given that we just had a non-peaceful transition of power, we have an educational system which is getting worse and worse. It would be a very good thing if Americans thought about democracy in terms of pieces that you can fix, rather than like, yay, we're a democracy, or boo, we're not.
That's Timothy Snyder, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Timothy Snyder on the state of American democracy. There's a new Jim Crow in the U.S. This 2.0 version is legislation passed by politicians who mouth pieties about protecting our sacred right to vote and the integrity of elections. After what is considered one of the most secure and verified elections in U.S. history, there's a wave of voter suppression laws being proposed across the country. According to the Brennan Center for Justice, Republican legislators in 43 states have introduced more than 250 bills that would make it harder to vote. These bills primarily seek to impose stricter voter ID requirements, reduce the number of polling places, limit mail drop boxes, and early voting. These actions are an open assault on the 1965 Voting Rights Act that Dr. King, John Lewis, and so many others fought for. What's going on with American democracy? Our guest today is Timothy Snyder. He's professor of history at Yale and a permanent fellow at the Institute for Human Sciences in Vienna, Austria. He's the author of Our Malady and On Tyranny. He spoke in Vienna on February 18th. Paige Herlinger, Bowdoin College professor, is the moderator. And now, Timothy Snyder.
It's very easy in the rush of the events of January 6th, it's very easy to yield the temptation to think that all political things have immediately political causes and all ideological utterances have immediately ideological sources. But I do think we have to keep in mind the fact that the United States had been in a terrible state of health for the previous year, that this itself and the falsehoods told around it and the controversies that it caused had something to do with the mood by early 2021. If you construct an alternative history of the year 2020 without the pandemic, a lot of the things which we felt as crises, as particular crises, probably wouldn't have happened or would have happened in a slightly different way. I want to make that assertion, but with that assertion, I also want to make a suggestion, which is that part of the reason why the U.S. is always more anxious and fearful than it has to be is that we have such disastrously poor healthcare. So when something happens like a pandemic, the levels of anxiety and fear and disagreement are simply greater than they have to be because we have such a disastrous system or non-system of national healthcare. And so although the point may seem very distant when you're thinking about, for example, you know, some guy with an Auschwitz t-shirt or some other guy with a Confederate flag rushing through the Capitol, I'm just going to insist here at the outset that that there are background structures which are also very important to our mood and to our overall comportment, and that one of those structures is health. Okay, so so epidemics, health are pretty much, as any historian would note, a pretty much permanent aspect of the human condition. Now let me narrow down a little bit and talk about a deep, some colleagues would probably say, the deep truth of U.S. political history, which is the history of race. Now, in connection with the events of January 6th, I think the crucial question is, what does democracy mean? Who are the people who rule, in that word democracy, who is actually to be represented. In American historical terms, the turning point here is the Civil War Reconstruction, or really the failure of Reconstruction. Now, very often folks ask, where can you look around the world to find comparisons so you can think about what's happening in the US now? I'm very happy to do that because I'm a historian of many things, but not of the US. But I do know enough about US history to say that you don't have to look around the world, that the failure of Reconstruction, the so-called compromise of 1877, leads directly to what we would call now a series of authoritarian, you know, non-democratic authoritarian regimes, that is the Southern states, places where the vote is artfully, if possible, but violently, if necessary, repressed such that de facto, for the better part of the next century, African Americans are not enfranchised. And this, by the way, let me just go off to the side for a second. This is very important when we think about these comparisons with other countries, because often, you know, there's this debate among my colleagues about whether one should talk about fascism or not talk about fascism. I think it's very important to talk about fascism because every historical reference point you have, every comparison you can make, enriches your ability to evaluate the present. But what I want to suggest here is that it's not that these things like fascism or even National Socialism are so distant from our own history that we have the luxury of saying, oh, that's a comparison. It's all part of one history, right? The history of racial discrimination, the history of racial politics is not one which is limited to one country or to another country. It's all one broad history. Okay, but bringing it back to the United States. So in our political history, since the 1870s, there's basically been one party, which has been the Voter Suppression Party. For a long time, that was the Democratic Party. They were the Voter Suppression Party. For the last 50, 60 years, it's been the Republican Party, which is the Voter Suppression Party. But we haven't been able to get out from under this curse of having one of the two major political parties be a Voter Suppression Party. And when you're a Voter Suppression Party, it's not just that you're committing the evil of suppressing votes. It's not just that you're standing for a system which is not completely democratic. It's also that the habit of suppressing votes leads you in certain directions, which bring you to a place which looks much like January 6th. And this happens in several ways. Number one, if you're a voter suppression party, you're less and less interested in policy. You're more and more interested in the kind of ideology or rhetoric which would justify you being in power, right? But you're less and less interested in policy because policy isn't what is keeping you in power. You're not actually competing. You're gaming the system. The second thing which happens if you're a voter suppression party is that your own constituents become more and more racialized, right? Since your whole object is to win the vote by keeping the African Americans and others districted in such a way that you do win local elections, step by step, year by year, as has happened to the Republicans, your own constituents, your own electorate becomes more and more racially homogenous. Of course, not perfectly so. There are plenty of Asian and African American and so on Republicans, but the general trend is clear, right? So you become more and more de facto a racial party. And then the final thing which happens to you is that if you suppress votes over and over in a democracy, you stop thinking about democracy as democracy with some exceptions, but you get into the habit of thinking of the system as a game, right? It's just there to be gamed. That's what it is. And once you get to that view, that the system is just there to be gamed, let's call that the Mitch McConnell view, you're not very far away from the view that the system might as well be broken. Because after all, if it's just a game, right, it's not a system, it's not a moral commitment, it's just a game, why not change the rules? So that's one logic which pushes you towards what happens on January 6th. Another logic coming out of the past is the notion of fraud, right? So who is represented, whose votes really get to count? When Newt Gingrich, for example, on election night goes on television and says there's going to be fraud in Atlanta, Philadelphia, Milwaukee, what is he saying? He's saying that in cities, i.e. where there are Black people, the votes don't really count. And Mr. Trump picks up this language not very long after that. Lindsey Graham does the same thing. He says there's a history of fraud in Philadelphia. There's no documentation for this. There's no reason for him to say that. What he's just trying to suggest is that these people are not really representative. And so this whole idea of fraud in our country is deeply racialized. It goes all the way back to post-Reconstruction. It goes deeply to the question of what democracy means, who gets to be represented, right? And so when you imagine then that scene on January 6th, where people are pouring into the Capitol building and they're chanting, "Whose house, our house?" This is what this means. It's an old, I mean, it may seem shocking, but it's an old American dispute about who gets to be represented and why. Does every citizen get to have a vote and be equally represented? Or do certain kinds of people get to be represented? Only certain kinds of people. All right. That brings me to the third point that I wanted to make, which is a more recent part of this time international history, which is the big lie. Now, the transition here is that the big lie that Mr. Trump told, and which lots of other people told along with him, the big lie that he won the election, this is identical to the big lie of American history. The big lie of American history is that Black people are not human beings. And that big lie of American history is what makes Mr. Trump's big lie possible. Because what he's really saying is, I would have won the election if you don't count all those quote unquote fraudulent ballots, which is to say, I really would have won the election if you don't count those Black people. I really would have won the election if you only count those white people. And of course, that's true. If we lived in a country where you only counted white people's votes, he indeed would have won the election. And so when you tell the lie that you win the election, you're basically repeating the big lie of American history, which is that Black people don't count. Black people are not really people. But the big lie itself has a structure. And I want to dwell on that structure because big lies are incompatible with democracy. Once you have a big lie in the system, you've got to surround it. You have to take the air out of it. You've got to deflate it. You have to make it go away because a big lie is incompatible with democracy. Okay, why do I mean this? And what is a big lie? Well, a big lie, I mean, first of all, is something which is just not true, clearly not true, right? In this case, you know, I don't have to recite it all. We know what the institution said. We know what the court said. We know what common sense says. You know, he was only challenging the vote counts in states where it was close and where it might turn things for him. That part is obvious. But the second feature of a big lie, it's not just that it's not true. It's something that if it were true, it would change the world, right? So, I mean, all politicians tell lies. I mean, controlled mendacity is part of the art of politics. But lies that politicians tell most of the time don't have the quality that if they were true, the whole world would be changed. A big lie does. If you believe that Mr. Trump won the election, you have to believe a whole bunch of other things as well, right? You have to believe that judges and state representatives and attorneys general and voting machines and Hugo Chavez, you have to believe a whole bunch of other things in order to believe that lie, which is what makes the lie a big lie. It takes over a huge amount of your reasoning space. It takes over a huge amount of the world. And so if you believe it, and belief is the key word here, you find yourself drawn into thinking that life is divided up into groups. Believers, the people who believe this thing that you believe, and those who don't believe the thing that you believe. And relatedly, if you believe in a big lie, you have to accept that you have to believe in a conspiracy theory. The two go together because the only way that Mr. Trump could have lost if he really won is if there was a conspiracy against him, right? So de facto, when you believe a big lie, you're also taking part in conspiracy and conspiracy thinking. So a big lie then is incompatible with democracy because a big lie means that you don't trust the institutions. You regard many, probably most of your fellow citizens as being evil because they're outside of your group of belief. And it also means that you're attached to the person who's telling the lie. And this is where things get interesting because looking into the future, because the person who tells the lie first is not always the person who rides it to power. So Mr. Trump tells this big lie It got him as far as a violent insurrection and a storming of the Capitol. It did not keep him in power. However, the lie continues, and not just because he continues to tell it. It continues because other people in his political party continue to tell it, including aspirants for the presidency in 2024, like Mr. Cruz and Mr. Hawley. And so what's interesting, I mean, interesting in a dark way, is that the lie can keep going, right? The lie has shaped the way people see the world. It creates its own alternative reality in which you can keep living. So just here's something to think about. An original big lie in 1918 was that Germany would have won the First World War if it hadn't been for the stab in the back. If it hadn't been for the Jews and the left, Germany would have won the First World War. That is a big lie, which was told by top-ranking German officers to explain why they lost the First World War, why it was someone else's fault. 15 years later, that lie is being told by Adolf Hitler, who did not originate it, but who took it and who developed it. And so when we think about the future of a big lie, then we have to ask, okay, in 15 years, what will the United States be like if people are still saying this? If we're in a country where people believe that the 2020 election was stolen, where major politicians are still saying that, will that country still be a democracy? I think that's very unlikely, frankly. Okay. The fourth thing that I wanted to talk about was the problem of mob rule, right? When I say mob rule, you immediately know what I'm talking about. I mean, your mind probably involuntarily sees that mob of people crowding the Capitol building, breaking through police lines, bringing, a gallows and a noose, talking about killing Mike Pence. Some of those people were actually looking to do harm and perhaps even to kill our elected representatives. When I say mob rule, you think about all that, and you should because it's important. But we need to take a step back and realize that mob rule is actually a form of politics. It's not just something which happens every now and again. It's not like getting drunk, it's like alcoholism. I mean, mob rule is not just this chancy once in a lifetime thing. It's an alternative set of political principles, which democracy is designed precisely to oppose. The whole point of representation is that we vote and then people following rules represent us, so that we don't have to use violence against one another, and so that we don't have to use violence against them. Democracy is meant to work against mob rule. Mob rule is incompatible with democracy for a couple of very important reasons. Number one is the rule of law. Democracy depends upon the rule of law, and the rule of law depends upon the state having a monopoly on the legitimate use of violence. Mob rule says, no, any one of us has the right to use violence at any time, basically because we feel like it. But there's also a deeper, more subtle, but maybe even more important point which goes on here. What mob rule does is that it says our representatives are our representatives insofar as they're afraid of us. That's what matters. Not because they know what's good for us or because we elected them or because of the law or anything like that. They're doing stuff because they're afraid of us. And that's a completely different principle. And it's the principle we saw on display on the 6th of January, sadly. We saw it on display. We don't want to look at this because this is too painful, but that is, of course, what happened. It's not just that on January 6th, our elected representatives, some of them, tried to delay or maybe even destroy, set aside an American election. It was that our elected representatives, even after the Capitol was stormed, they still voted against democracy. And so, that's a bad thing. Like if you owe your job to elections, you should be voting against mob rule and not for it. And then what's even worse than that, and I'm going to insist that this is worse, is the aspect of fear. So they're mostly anonymous, and this is reported secondhand and so on. But we know that a number of Republican representatives and senators say we're voting the way that we vote on January 6th, or we're voting the way we vote in the impeachment trial because we're afraid. We're afraid. We're afraid of our own electorate. We're afraid of violence. We're afraid of Trump encouraging violence. And then we think, oh, you poor people, you're afraid. And I want to state here very strongly, that's the wrong reaction. that's the wrong reaction, because that's giving in to mob rule. Okay, fear, like there are all kinds of female journalists and all kinds of, you know, all kinds of people in color in politics who are getting threats all the time, right? All the time. And they get on with it. When an old white male senator feels like he's in some kind of threatened position, then we all say, okay, that's very bad. I'm sorry to hear that. We got to be careful here, because if that's our move, I'm noting now that it's heavily gendered and racialized, because it is. But if that's our move, then what we're saying is mob rule is fine. If we take this turn in January, February 2021, and we say, okay, those guys are afraid, therefore it's fine that they don't vote their consciences, they don't vote the law, they just do the stuff that they should do because they're afraid. We are then complicit in inviting violence in as the final determinant of our own politics, right? And see, because the problem here is, and this is an old game, right? This is a game that mobsters play. It's a game that the secret police play. Once you admit, oh, I'm afraid, I'll do what you want. Once you do that once, then they just keep coming back for you, and they're going to do it again. Or maybe somebody else will come back to you and they'll threaten you another time. So the problem with mob rule is that it's not just that we have a mob. It's also that we seem to have elected representatives who are willing to say, oh, I'm afraid of that mob. And once you say, oh, I'm afraid of that mob, that's when you have the real problem, right? That's when you move towards something which I would really not like to see in the United States of America, but which history shows us can happen, which is a parliament which is basically there as a facade. A parliament which is basically there to provide a kind of pretty cover for decisions which have actually been made by a competition of violence, which have actually been made by, you know, the people behind the scenes who provide the most credible threat against given elected representatives. That is where we do not want to go. We do not want to go towards mob rule. Now, we've taken some steps in that direction because a mob seized control of the Capitol, because we've had these two votes, January 6th and the impeachment trial vote, which were clearly influenced by the fear of violence. We've taken steps in that direction because we have a politician now in Florida who clearly is interested in issuing threats. So we have to name this problem for what it is, recognize that mob rule is it's not just something that happens now and again. It's not just some random event. It's an alternative form of politics that you have to be able to name and to head off. Okay, so the last word I wanted to say is about the future. Where I want to close on is just a word about learning. So on the negative side, the people who study coups will say, the problem with a failed coup is that a failed coup is usually the last thing that happens before the successful coup. So when a coup d'etat attempt fails in your country, which has just happened in the United States of America, you don't then go home and say, oh, the institutions saved us, right? I mean, when I hear that, I'm not really frightened by that many things in politics, but that particular reaction frightens me. If people say, oh, well, the coup attempt didn't work because the institutions saved us, no, that's not the right reaction. If you get this close, right, if you really have armed people and bombs in your parliament, if you really have a president who's trying to overturn an election, you can't say the institutions worked. What you have to say is, how can we improve those institutions? Because the people who fail in a coup are teaching the people who are going to succeed in the next coup. So if you're not learning yourself from the coup attempt, you're going to lose the next time around. Now, the positive side of that is that what this teaches us, hopefully, is that the United American democracy has a lot of room for improvement. That posture that everybody, that not everybody, that so many people took in 2016, 2017, that the institution, we're an exceptional nation, you know, greatest democracy ever, and so on, our institutions will protect us, that posture did not work. So what this suggests to us is that democracy is not some kind of a machine. It's not some kind of historical inevitability. Democracy needs support. Democracy needs moral support. We have to say that this is a system we want, not some other kind of system. It needs structural support, which we can talk about more. But one of the structures that it needs is healthcare. Another structure that it needs is support of factuality. And also, democracy needs not a whole lot, not every day, not all the time, but now and then it also needs a little bit of courage. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Lots of food for thought already, and we have quite a few questions coming in. I think I'd like to start with one of the very first questions that came in that asks you to elaborate a little bit more on this question of where we are as a democracy. And it starts with the Freedom House. This is from, I should mention, Dr. David Dixon, class of Bowdoin class of 1976, asking about whether you agree with Freedom House's assessment that the U.S. is no longer a full democracy, and do you concur that the dominant faction of the Republican Party is authoritarian in the wake of its behavior following the 2020 election and its ardent support of voter suppression? But I want to follow up on that a little bit and just and ask you for some more structural ideas for how we can, moving forward, combat some of these very real problems that you have been mentioning with respect to mob rule, fear. I think a lot of people have been asked, what is the road forward and what can we do sitting from our, you know, in front of our screens? But what can we do to help pave a better path forward?
Okay. On Dr. Dixon's question, though, first directly, yeah, I do agree with Freedom House's assessment. I mean, the interesting thing about Freedom House, and it's actually a positive sign about American civil society, is that it's an American organization which rates democracies, and it's a good thing that Freedom House is capable of rating America's democracy. I mean, that's not what it was really founded for, honestly, but it's a very good thing. And I agree with their assessment. I mean, they've done a good job in noting that democracy has been in retreat for, it's about the last 15 years, which is good to have that on the record, because it's only the past few years that we've noticed it, but the trend is actually much longer than that. And yes, I mean, it'd be hard to characterize the United States as a fully functioning democracy, given the inappropriate role that money plays, given in our elections, given how difficult it is for such a big part of our citizenship to vote. I mean, given that we just had a non-peaceful transition of power. And then there are all kinds of things which might seem secondary. We have a very poor information environment. We have an educational system which is getting worse and worse. So yeah, I think that it's good. It would be a very good thing if Americans thought about democracy in terms of pieces that you can fix, rather than like, yay, we're a democracy, or boo, we're not, right? Because often what people do is they say, yeah, we've been a great democracy up to now, but all of a sudden things have gone wrong. Oh, well, too bad. But that's not how it works, right? How it works is that you have these problems already, and if you can pick them off, you can make things better. Democracy can only work, so to speak, in the future. It can't work in the past. And this is a key part of the way authoritarianism works now. And you can see it on the example of Mr. Trump as well. You cancel the future. We're in the year 2021. That is a science fiction year, right? Like, if you're like me and you grew up in the 70s and 80s of the last century, the year 2021, like, if that were a book title, I mean, that would be announcing some kind of year of like a fantastic possibility. But that kind of future, like that sense of the future is going to be way better or very different, at least for all of us, that's gone away. And that's crucial for understanding present day authoritarian trends. Because if what's happened is that a lot of people's own futures have gone away. Because, and this is something Mr. Trump has right, actually, you know, the American dream being dead, social advancement is much harder in the United States than it used to be. And there are things we could do about that. We could make it easier for trade unions to function. We could work on inequality of wealth and income, which basically amounts to the same thing as lack of social mobility. We could build up the welfare state so that people have more predictable lives and have a better chance of changing their lives because some things are more predictable. You have to give people a sense of the future. If people don't have an individual sense of the future, then you don't have a collective sense of the future. And democracy depends on a sense of the future, because democracy depends on vote. It's, you know, there's this little element of faith in it, right? This idea that if we roll the dice this time, we vote this time, things might be better than the last time.
You're listening to Timothy Snyder on the State of American Democracy. This is Independent Alternative Radio.
So it depends on, you know, your own ability to think about the future, to learn to think that this election might be better than the last election. And then my two personal big ones, and again, note that these things have to do with the future. My number one would be factuality. underline a lot of the stuff which is going on, like the possibility of the big lie, the anger of the mob, underline a lot of that, even the racism, which is worse than the conspiracy thinking, underline a lot of that is the social media reality which we've allowed to arise in this country. And I made this point earlier today on a TV show. People say like, oh, but that's just like nature. You can't change that. That's just nature. But no, I mean, social media in the US functions differently than in other countries. I'm in another country right now, and I can say that that's true. And these things are all historically, you know, these things are all historically contingent. They can be changed. In the late 19th century, early 20th century, there were also lots of big concerns, like big firms, trusts, they were called back then, which people said, oh, these are big, it's nature, you can't do anything about it. And you couldn't until you did, right? I mean, there's a reason why we have antitrust. Antitrust is there to create competition. We have a situation where too few firms are in charge of too much information flow, and they work too well in the sense that they're too good at making money. And the way they make money is by playing off the things you already believe. In other words, I mean, I'm simplifying a little bit, but not that much. Social media is basically a con game. It's a con game in that it gets your confidence by telling you the stuff that it's figured out that you already want to hear, and then drawing you further in there to keep your eyeballs on the screen so advertisers can make money, which is the opposite of being informed. I mean, hearing what you want to hear and being and having that monetized is the opposite of reading the newspaper and finding things out that you didn't know and maybe surprise you, but you really should know. Like, for example, that your children are drinking, you know, mercury in the water, to take a classic example. So one of my big ones is we have to have local news. We can't do without local news. That has to be a project, because local news creates, it allows for conversations about the things that actually matter to people, and prevents us from immediately jumping to Washington, you know, because of course we have different ideological values. That's fine. But we have to have a common set of facts. Without that, you can't really have a democracy. And then climate change. I mean, climate change seems unconnected to all this, a little bit like health, but it's directly connected. The sense that, you know, if you don't believe in climate change, then this may not affect you. But for the vast majority of Americans who do, the fact that there is climate change and we're not doing anything about it, or we're not doing nearly as much as we should, that also compresses the future. It makes people feel hopeless. It makes us feel like, well, what's the point in acting now? Like, we don't really have that long of a time horizon anywhere. It increases anxiety and fear. If we could fix climate change, I mean, this is the thing about, like, we could do it. We could turn it around, you know, and if we were solving climate change, that would be pushing the future outwards, and we'd feel much less afraid, and we'd start to have a future, you know, into which we could look. So those are some of my big ideas about that.
A lot of questions have come in. I'm going to pull up one from one of my former students, who is asking a little bit more about the big lie. And he asked specifically, what historical examples are there of an honest democracy overcoming the big lie, mentioning that in Nazi Germany, the alternative reality of the big lie did not fully unravel until the latter stages of the war. I think the bigger question here is, obviously, are there real things that we can do to combat it right now? As you said, in 15 years, if it's still around, our democracy is in trouble.
It's a great point about the big lie, and that's something that has me very concerned too, because unfortunately, you don't usually get out of a big lie unless you're shocked by something. Because it's like any other form of addiction, let's call it. I mean, it's very hard to, the whole point is that once you're inside a big lie, you can't really be reasoned out of it, because it's internally consistent for you. It doesn't depend upon external evidence. It's internally consistent. And so anything or anybody which appears to be against it just in a way confirms it, because you already know that the world's divided into us and them. You already know there's a conspiracy against you, right? So it's hard to penetrate it that way. And unfortunately, the sociological reality is that it often does depend on some kind of a shock, right down to the end of the war. You know, if you read like Victor Klemperer, for example, about, you know, examples of like returning crippled German soldiers in April of 1945, still thinking that the Führer is telling the truth, you know, still thinking that like somehow there's a miracle weapon, right? And what I want to avoid is an America where we have a deep lie which is so entrenched and lasts for so long that we have to be shocked like that to get out of it. Eventually we will be, because I mean, among other things, believing in a big lie like this will, it will make, I mean, so much of our You know, we're not China. If we want to be China, that's a different story. But if America is going to work, America has to depend. America depends upon is a trust society, and trust societies depend upon habits of truth and truthfulness, at least, you know, within some kind of a limit. If we stop being a trust society and start becoming a belief society, you know, then we're divided up into clans where one clan believes this and one clan believes that. And it's not just that politics won't work then. The market isn't going to work as well then either. A lot of things that we take, the law isn't going to work as well. Civil society isn't going to work as well. A lot of things that we take for granted will stop working if we're living in this big lie. Okay, enough dark stuff. I do think that there are some things that can be done about this particular big lie now. I mean, number one, politicians in Washington had, beginning November 3rd, but, you know, better late than never, the obligation to simply talk about what the election results were. And insofar as they're not doing that, they are taking part in this big lie. Number two, and now there's talk, I mean, this is something I've been talking about for, 7 weeks now, but I think that Congress is actually going to do it. There has to be some kind of blue ribbon panel, some kind of commission, which brings in, and by the way, like, if you like this idea, please tell your elected representatives about it, because it's, I think it's much more important than they realize. There has to be some kind of commission, which includes forensics people, digital forensics people, lawyers, security experts, historians, scholars who work on race, a total view which tries to get our minds around what happened on January 6th, how it was possible, institutionally, historically, from every possible angle, and to produce a report which is there on the record for any judge in the future who needs it, for any historian in the future who needs it, for any school, any college in the future that wants to teach it, you know, in a 100-page report. Maybe it has 10,000 pages of appendices, but in a 100-page report, which gets clear what happened and how it could have happened, it seems like a simple step, not very dramatic, but it would make a huge difference, right? I hope that will happen. And then the third thing I would say is that, to what I already said, the big lie works in a certain kind of media environment. And so you don't address it directly, but you do address it effectively if you can fill up the world with more factuality, give people other things to care about, things in their own lives to care about. That will also, it won't do away with it, but it will change the atmosphere.
Great. Joe Leghorn has posed a question about whether or not you believe Americans still share a set of common values. And if not, how can we as Americans try to retrieve a set of common values? I think this speaks to the question not only of values, but when we are so polarized in our kind of core beliefs, or at least imagine that we are, how do we even begin a conversation where we're using, I don't know, even the same vocabulary? How do we even initiate that? I think we're all struggling to figure that one out. You know, even within our own families, I think many of us saw the letter that Adam Kinzinger, the Illinois congressman's family, sent to him when he voted his conscience and voted to impeach. And his family, you know, there was a kind of tribalism, but it was steeped in a shared set of beliefs that they felt that he had betrayed. And if that's happening on the level of the family, how can we as a society find that space for a real dialogue over issues, not even the issues that are sort of the ones that divide us, but even if there are common values? So this is a two-part question. Are there common values? And then how do we start a healthier or a conversation, a productive conversation about them again?
Yeah. It's a wonderful question. I think you can't really do without values. And that's going to be the beginning of my answer. One thing that conservatives have had right and liberals have basically had wrong is the necessity of values for a democracy. I mean, a democracy is not just about my individual preferences or your individual preferences. It's not just about my individual interests or your individual interests. A democracy depends upon valuing, and I'm not saying, by the way, the conservatives always have the right values. I'm just saying that I think they have been right about the issue of values. a democracy also depends upon values. It depends upon, for example, the value of pacifism, that you're not going to fight violently about an election result. It depends on the value of toleration, that your neighbor has the right to vote differently than you do. It depends on the value of truth, that a democracy is an enlightened project, which assumes that we as creatures can do better than just responding to our immediate urges and impulses, that we're also capable of learning, drawing judgments. That value commitment to truth is part of what I think folks on the left or liberals should consider. Or since I'm not being really straightforward, I think they should embrace it. Because what's happened with simplifying a little bit, but what's happened is that the embrace on the left of the idea that there's not really much point of pursuing truth because every experience is individual and subjective is then, of course, weaponized by the people who actually have the wealth and the capacity to project subjectivity. And that's Mr. Trump. I mean, that's the story of Mr. Trump in a nutshell. He weaponizes the idea that there's no objective truth and there's no moral value in pursuing it, that all that matters are feelings. And it turns out that when all that matters are feelings, what really matters are the feelings of the powerful, not surprisingly. So the way that you get at the powerful is not with feelings. The way you get at the powerful is with facts. But you can only have facts if you've decided, you know, a priori that facts are a value, that factuality is a value. And by the way, when I say that, I don't mean to dismiss the different experiences of people in the United States. On the contrary, I mean, embracing factuality means, for example, knowing how many people are incarcerated in the United States. It means knowing how much more likely it is for an African-American to die of COVID in the United States. It means knowing, you know, how much more likely an African-American woman is to die in childbirth in the United States. Those are all facts. And on the basis of facts, I mean, wealth inequality is a classic example. I think wealth inequality is probably the biggest problem in this country, but wealth inequality is a matter of numbers. And if you don't see the numbers, if you don't, you really can't appreciate the qualitative reality of it. So I think a value commitment that we have to have is the value commitment to factuality. And then the last thing that I wanted to say about this is that there is a value that I think a lot of people, not everybody, but a lot of people in the United States, probably most people in the United States, would say that they accept, which is freedom. And here, I think our big problem is that when we say the word, we don't know what we're talking about. Or we're talking about, I mean, sometimes sad to say, we're talking about nothing. We're talking about what I feel like doing at the moment. And what I feel like doing at the moment is what I feel like doing at the moment, but it's not freedom. I mean, what I feel like doing in the moment, there's so many things that go into that. So many, you know, so many humans and machines and causes and accidents, which go into how I feel at the moment. My freedom is something else. I mean, my freedom comes from my ability to decide who I am and how I'm going to project myself into the world and how I want to change the world. Freedom is a special part of this problem, which is that we all talk about it, but it's not clear what we mean by it. And I'm hopeful that if we had a discussion about what we mean by it, we might get a little bit closer to not to all having a common set of values. I don't really believe in that, but get closer at least to having some of these core values that democracy depends upon.
I think this is actually a related question, but it takes the issue in a slightly different direction. And it's from a recent Bowdoin alum who asks, I'm wondering if Professor Snyder knows of any historical parallels or can offer a perspective on the enthusiastic support of politicians and rhetoric that is clearly against their own interests. For example, there's plenty of demonization of immigrants by other immigrants, and polling of the 2020 election shows that many people of color voted for President Trump. How do we understand individuals who embrace ideologies and politicians that don't represent them?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. Can I just talk about other democracies for a second, though?
And then by all means.
Healthcare is one of them, but there are also some much more surface level differences, which are really important. Other countries don't allow dark money the way we do. Other countries have publicly financed political campaigns that have beginnings and endings, as opposed to obscurely financed political campaigns that don't have beginnings and endings. Other countries don't allow oligarchs or companies to intervene in elections in states that they have nothing to do with. Ohio has gambling because people far, far away intervene with lots of money in TV advertisements. Most other countries of democracies don't think that it's particularly democratic for people who have disposable wealth to be able to frame the whole conversation. That's a difference. The Citizens United, the 2010 Supreme Court case, basically ruled that money talks, like money's a person. I don't happen to believe that money is a person. I think money's money and people are people. I think people have voices and money doesn't. But that's a view that has to be defended. And in the US, we have kind of let ourselves slip to this point where we accept that if you got a lot of money, that means you get to frame the conversation. Other democracies don't accept that view. And I think that makes a big difference. I mean, the European Union in general is doing a much better job handling the big social media platforms. It's not just migrants or Black people. I would say it's not Black people that vote against their own interests. It's white people that vote against their own interests in the U.S. I mean, if you used interest in the kind of most academic, least contested sense, which is economic interest, it's not Black people that are doing that. It's white people. White people are the big practitioners of identity politics in this country. So I'm just taking interest in a very, narrow sense, like you should be voting your pocketbook. That's white people. That's us. That's the white people who are doing that. The white people are engaged in this tribal politics. If you're voting against the welfare state, if you're voting against taxing rich people, that's when you're voting against your own interests. That's what white folks do. I mean, again, there are exceptions, right? I mean, I understand, but most white people in most elections are voting against their own interests. Or if you want to do it red state, blue state, the red states, almost all of them are net recipients of federal money. And the blue states, most of them, are net in payers to the federal government. Senator McConnell, for example, complains a lot about the federal government, but Kentucky gets roughly three times as much money from the federal government as it puts in. And that's typical. Very red states, that's generally the case. And so every time a red state votes red, it's voting against its own interests. Every single time, if we're just talking about narrow financial interests. So I just want to expand the question and ask why, right? I agree with you, why? And then just posing the question that way, realizing that most people are voting against their interests most of the time, kind of makes it seem less abnormal and makes you think, okay, what actually motivates people to vote? The way I think about it is that there are two different political equilibria, and you can, you got to fight to get from one of them to the other. In one political equilibrium, which is a good one for democracy, folks are generally not racist. Historical discussions about difference have taken place, that there's a healthy information environment in which you can more or less make decisions about your interests by having accurate information. That's a kind of idealized equilibrium point, for democracy. For authoritarianism, the idealized equilibrium point is there's not a really good information environment. Historical differences are magnified rather than resolved. Politics becomes a matter of us and them. So your own personal interests don't matter so much because it's all about the us and the them, or it's all about the leader who tells you about the us and the them. And in that political equilibrium point, you suffer. You're supposed to suffer. I mean, you suffer, and that shows, you don't wear that mask. You don't take care of yourself. You suffer, and you think that suffering has a point. There's a sadism and a masochism which comes into authoritarianism. I mean, to put like direct labels on it, people like to suffer. They like to, in this world, right? They like to be lied to. It's not just they are lied to. It's that they like to be lied to. It's not just they suffer. It's they like to suffer because they think it's serving some kind of a point. And that is how human beings could be. And that is why democracy is a struggle. Because if you just tell people, hey, don't you want to be free? That's not really enough. That will not get you democracy, as we're seeing in the United States now. We are hovering between these two political equilibria points. And people are, people are very capable of both, but it's democracy which requires more of the effort. And it's a structural effort. It's not just a moral effort. It's a structural effort to build structures such that people have access to information, such that they learn to think in terms of interest and not in terms of tribes and so on.
I thought you were going to connect that to your argument about the politics of eternity, because I definitely see some connections there.
I mean, one way, I mean, in the authoritarian point of political equilibrium, there isn't a future, right? So if there's not a future, then the whole notion of interests doesn't really exist, because an interest can only exist in the future. An interest is something where you you make some kind of commitment or decision now, and it gets paid off in the future, right? Because you have an interest, but an interest only exists in a timescape where there's a future. If you can take the future out of politics and make politics only about making America great again, for example, if you can make only make politics about envisioning the time when America was great, then what you've succeeded in doing is taking interests out of the center of politics and replacing politics with identity, basically. Like, let's identify with that time when we were on top, right? Let's not do anything to give ourselves a better chance in the future. Let's just identify with that time when we were on top. And so time is very, very important here, you know, and that's why politicians like Mr. Trump, Mr. Putin is also very good at this. Politicians who are able to knock the future off the table are also knocking the question of interests off the table. And then suddenly the question isn't why aren't people voting their interests? Because they, you can't, if there's no future, you can't really have an interest. All you can have is an identification. An identification doesn't demand policy. An identification just demands reassurance. Identification demands clear definition of the enemy. Identification demands a story, but it doesn't demand policy. It doesn't demand policy that affects your interests.
Another question asks, it says hindsight is brilliant, but foresight remains the challenge. How do we anticipate such a catastrophe and not take action to address it before it becomes a tragedy? I'm hoping this will be a time when you can not only do what you do best, which is to help us use our past to make sense of our future, but also give us some things looking forward that we can actually think about and maybe even do. So any thoughts that you might leave us with today?
I think one of the things you can do to look forward is to pay more attention to the past. And this also, I mean, it, part of our authoritarian problem in this country is the crushing of the humanities. Because, I mean, and nothing against science, love science, my kids love science, I love science, I was a math team champ, it's all great. But the thing about that stuff is that it doesn't actually prepare you for the values of the future. It gets you set up, you know, especially the way it's taught now, it gets you set up to be a functional person, a problem solver, and so on. But only the humanities create the possibility of thinking about how the future should be, and only the humanities create the imagination of that allows you to broaden possibility, because the actual possibilities for good and ill are always much bigger than we think they are. So one thing, and again, it seems indirect, but it's not. I mean, there's a reason why the same people who don't like democracy are the people who are trying to crush college campuses, and particularly the humanities. And that's because the humanities are the thing which give us imagination about the future, both in terms of should and in terms of can. I mean, there are lots of smaller things that people could do. If every one of you goes home after this seminar and subscribes to a newspaper, you've done something good, because the reporters are the people who are actually making a difference. Especially if you subscribe to a print newspaper, you're doing a lot of good. Run for local office. You know, there's this kind of terrible gravity in the U.S. where all we talk about is national politics, and that's one of our syndromes. The democracy is actually going to be decided by the states, and that's where it's most at risk, actually. And that's American history, too, is that democracy is most at risk at the level of the states. So running for office, like, we need good people to run for attorney general. We need good people to run for the local positions that involve elections. Those are things that people can do. And then there are value commitments, I mean, which I don't expect you to immediately agree with me about, but I would like you to at least think about, like, the value commitment to factuality. I don't think we can do without that, because if the people who want change are not sure about the existence of facts, and the people who want authoritarianism are confident of their beliefs, then you're doomed. If it's false convictions up against uncertainty about the existence of truth, false convictions are going to win every time. You know, so there's some value things here that are worth thinking about. And for me, the most important value is commitment, is factuality. Thank you very much.
You were just listening to Timothy Snyder on the state of American democracy. He spoke in Vienna, Austria on February 18th. Timothy Snyder is professor of history at Yale and the author of On Tyranny. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and progressive and in our 35th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. If you'd like a free copy of a printed transcript, PDF, or MP3 of this program, just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.